Well, Michelle Goldberg, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Your book, Kingdom Coming, The Rise of Christian Nationalism, is terrifying. Christian nationalism has penetrated into the very centers of our national government, our military, our corporate culture. These are all things that your book outlines in detail. What is Christian nationalism, and how did this come about?
Okay, well, I'm glad you asked me what Christian nationalism is, because I think it's important to differentiate it from Christian fundamentalism or evangelical Christianity. Somewhere between 30 to 40% of Americans identify as evangelical Christians. And I'm certainly not talking about all of them in Kingdom Coming. I'm talking about a subset, depending on the kind of questions that you ask and the surveys that you look at, somewhere probably between 10 and 15% of the population. And I see this as much more of a political ideology, really, than a religious one, although it kind of comes, you know, garbed in the robes of religion. It has an entire revisionist history. So it holds that the founders never intended to separate church and state. They intended to create a Christian nation, and that what they often call the myth of separation is this fraud that was introduced in the last 100 years. And so what needs to happen for America to regain its lost glory is to rid itself of secularism and reinstitute what they often call a biblical worldview. And that means Christianizing all kinds of institutions, you know, from the schools to the military to health policy to the sciences. So it's something that encompasses everything from the push to have intelligent design taught in public schools and to really redefine science to include supernatural causes, as they've done in some states, to our foreign policy, where, you know, right now under the president's emergency plan for AIDS relief, two-thirds of the money that that America allocates for AIDS prevention is going to abstinence programs, often run by either American missionaries or local religious fundamentalists, that not just that they don't provide condoms, they openly deride condoms, they tell people they don't work, they're sinful, and it's just had, you know, kind of catastrophic consequences.
A lot of what you talk about kept on reminding me of Sharia, of, you know, the theocracies of Islamic fundamentalism. I guess I wonder if you see some of those parallels, and in fact you do talk about sometimes where there have been coalitions made between these folks and between Islamic fundamentalists.
Yeah, which is really amazing, because, you know, there's so much hatred on the one level, but yes, especially at the United Nations, they've made some kind of pretty explicit alliances when it comes to fighting things like treaties on women's rights and children's rights and, you know, initiatives to foster reproductive health. I should say that I don't think most Christian nationalists want to establish a kind of Christian Taliban. There's a group that does. They're called the Christian Reconstructionists, and they do envision replacing civil law with Old Testament biblical law, you know, the execution of homosexuals, adulterers, women who are unchaste before marriage, all kinds of people. And although they're a pretty marginal group, what I find frightening is the extent to which some of their political ideology has found a kind of broader purchase within the broader Christian right, so that you'll start hearing ideas developed by the Christian Reconstructionists seeping into the broader discourse. But the goal of the broader movement is not so much a kind of Taliban-style theocracy as it is, you know, if you think about the Middle Eastern countries before the creation of Israel, when people of other faiths were often protected, they could kind of live there. I mean, there were pogroms, but, you know, they had more religious freedom, say, you know, than Europe for many years. But as long as the religious minorities knew their place. And so that's what I see. They kind of say, you know, we tolerate you, but you're here kind of at our sufferance.
There's a Joshua Generation Fellowship Church that's going up in Granby, which is the town just south of Amherst here.
Mm-hmm.
And for a long time, I was wondering, what is this Joshua Generation Fellowship? And now I have a clearer idea. Tell us about that, and tell us about its link to some of the more militant wings of this movement.
Sure. Well, Generation Joshua, and I'm assuming that's the same organization that you're talking about. Generation Joshua, the idea comes from, you know, this very violent biblical metaphor, which is, you know, Moses led his people out of the exile of Egypt. Joshua led the reconquering of the Holy Land. And so the idea behind Generation Joshua is that a previous generation, the former generation of the Christian right leadership, led people out of the bondage of secular society. The Joshua generation is going to reconquer America. And Generation Joshua is, besides being the name of a book by Michael Ferris, the founder of Patrick Henry College, is also the name of an organization that he started. And the idea behind it is to take homeschool kids, and the homeschooling movement is in many ways the vanguard of the Christian nationalist movement. So to take homeschooled kids who've been, you know, inculcated with this alternative revisionist history, revisionist science, you know, this kind of parallel reality, and to channel them into political activism and ultimately into political life. You know, I remember I was at a big homeschooling conference in Colorado, and Ned Ryan, who's the head of Generation Joshua, and he's also a former Bush speechwriter and the son of a congressman, was talking about how every single policy and government decision comes from either one of two worldviews, either the Christian worldview or the kind of so-called secular humanist worldview, so that everything the government does is kind of a decision between good and evil, and that he trains these kids through Generation Joshua to have the correct worldview, to make every decision according to it, and then to justify those decisions into kind of secular language. And Generation Joshua also pays the all of the travel and living expenses for hundreds of homeschool kids to go volunteer full-time on conservative political campaigns during campaign season. And Patrick Henry College, which is the college that Michael Ferris started, has been very, very successful in getting its graduates into government, into the administration. One of the kind of more striking statistics I use in the book is that there was one year when Patrick Henry College, you know, a college that has been around for about 6 years and has less than 300 students, provided 7% of the interns in the White House.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're speaking with Michelle Goldberg about her book Kingdom Coming, The Rise of Christian Nationalism. It sounds like almost a kind of stealth takeover. You know, those of us who are out in the mainstream, I guess, and I'm not used to thinking of myself in the mainstream, but kind of have a sense of unease, you know, that something is going on. We see being passed in government that just fill us with absolute dismay. We can't believe this is happening in America. But it's not clear why this is happening, how this is happening. I think your book really does talk about that. But why? Why is this movement grown the way it has? And talk about the stealth aspect of it as well.
Sure. Well, I mean, the stealth aspect is not really new. It's just kind of now reaching its fruition, I would say. You can look at the kind of development of the religious right as developing from big national organizations to dispersed and decentralized organizations. So you begin with the Moral Majority in 1979, and the Moral Majority, you know, started by Jerry Falwell, was one big national organization that did rallies and mailings and things like that. Then it was kind of succeeded by the Christian Coalition. And the Christian Coalition, which grew out of the ashes of Pat Robertson's presidential campaign, was a much more grassroots-based organization. I mean, all of these people who had worked for Pat Robertson had become involved in local Republican politics, and the Christian Coalition really, really capitalized on that. And the idea was to take over the Republican Party precinct by precinct, school board by school board, town council by town council. And they were very, very effective at it. And this is a kind of strategy that comes from, I was talking before about Christian Reconstructionism. You know, Christian Reconstructionists will talk about the need to kind of slowly smooth the transition to Christian rule. Gary North, who is one of the kind of key theorists of the movement, wrote that he needed, that activists had to kind of penetrate secular institutions. Quote, Christians must begin to organize politically within the present party structure, and they must begin to infiltrate the existing institutional order. And so that's really what Ralph Reed at the Christian Coalition did. You know, I have a quote from him, it's kind of a famous quote, where he says, I want to be invisible, I paint my face and travel at night. You don't know it's over until you're in a body bag. You don't know until election night. And so what they would do is they would often put up people for, say, a school board post or a town council post, and the only people who really knew what their agenda was were the people in the churches that were, you know, getting the mailers. And everybody else, you know, they seemed much more innocuous to everyone else. And then they would kind of only unveil their agenda once they'd been elected. And there was some backlash to that strategy, obviously. I mean, people weren't pleased when they found out that they had been, like, kind of tricked into voting for people, you know, whose goals they didn't share. But it was successful enough that now this is a movement that really, really dominates the Republican Party. You know, you can look at things like, and I would encourage listeners actually to look at the platform of the Texas Republican Party, because it's a really remarkable document, and it talks about how this is a Christian nation, and it talks about sodomy as something that's tearing at the fabric of society. The dominance of the movement within the political party is such that, for example, even before 2004, when you had, you know, a kind of a conservative sweep with a lot of new right-wing politicians coming into power, even before that, the Christian Coalition gave 42 out of 100 senators ratings of 100% approval, which means that 42 senators voted with the Christian Coalition on every issue that the Christian Coalition considered important.
100% of the time.
Right. And so you have to think, you know, 42% of the American people do not agree 100% of the time with the Christian Coalition. You know, and I'm not saying in many ways that the kind of organizing they've done is, I mean, I think the secretive aspect of it is illegitimate, but in many cases they've used, you know, legitimate organizing tactics, and they've just done it very, very well.
They also disguise their language. You also talk about this. What are some of the ways in which they actually disguise, you know, there are these coded words, these tropes that they use that, you know, nobody else really knows outside of their circles really knows what they refer to. For example, you talk about compassionate conservatism.
Right. Well, I think compassionate conservatism is one of the more important ones, because I think to most people who heard that just thought of it as a banality. You know, it's just a kind of empty campaign slogan. But compassionate conservatism is actually the title of a book by a guy named Marvin Alasky. And Marvin Alasky is someone who's very close to Bush. In fact, Bush wrote the introduction. And Alasky was an early advisor to Bush's 2000 campaign. And he's also, although he was born Jewish, he had a conversion. He's a fundamentalist Christian, very close to the kind of most radical elements within at least the nonviolent religious right. And what he wants to see happen is for welfare and job training and the kind of whole social infrastructure to be turned over to churches. And importantly, he sees conversion as a kind of key element in recovery. He talks about time spent in the pit of hell is sometimes necessary to save a life from debauch and a soul from hell. This is somebody who's been incredibly influential in shaping the so-called faith-based policy of the Bush administration. You know, Bush has transferred billions of dollars to religious charities, some of them, you know, kind of really overtly sectarian. And he's done another thing, and this is another kind of almost Orwellian use of language, is he's promoted something that he calls religious freedom in hiring rights. And what that means is the right to hire people only of your religion.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're speaking with Michelle Goldberg about her book Kingdom Coming, The Rise of Christian Nationalism. I think that a lot of people might say, well, you know, what's wrong with faith-based organizations? You know, Lutheran or Catholic Charities has been around for a long time. They've done really good work. And if people don't like it, they can go someplace else.
Well, Catholic Charities and Lutheran Social Services and all these places have gotten government contracts for a long time. And I don't really see a problem with that. The difference is that they used to have to abide by the same kind of civil rights law as everybody else. In terms of if people don't like it, they can go somewhere else, that's not really true. If your kid's taken into foster care, you don't really get a choice of where they're being taken. And with some of the faith-based drug rehab centers that I write about, you know, I was at Set Free Indeed, which is faith-based drug rehab totally based on the Bible and the idea that conversion will set you free of your addictions in Louisiana. First of all, it's a really nice place. They're well-funded, and it's a really kind of welcoming environment. So if you are, say, given a court order to seek drug treatment, and there's a waiting list at a bunch of dingy secular facilities, and then here's this really nice new place, I mean, I think a lot of, you know, some people obviously appreciate the spiritual component. You know, some people feel like they belong there. but it's definitely not a kind of a neutral decision. Do we want to move towards a country where our social services are segregated according to religious criteria, and then we're fighting over funding according to our religious sects or lack thereof? I mean, it just seems like a really dangerous direction.
And a lot of that funding for non-faith-based groups is getting decreased, whereas those funds are being channeled to the faith-based organizations.
Right, absolutely. And so it's not really a kind of a neutral decision, because the other ones are being starved and the faith-based organizations are just being lavished with new money.
And talk about what that means in terms of some critical areas. I mean, you know, we've all heard about the Bush administration's assault on science.
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean when it comes to things like HIV or AIDS or reproductive health and things of that kind?
Well, that's one of the kind of biggest aspects of all this. First of all, the funding of abstinence-only programs. A lot of this movement disdains the very idea of secular, rational science and empirical evidence. I'm going to read a quote from a woman named Pam Stenzel that Bush put on a 12-person panel at the Department of Health and Human Services overseeing abstinence education. And abstinence education has gotten about $1 billion under the Bush administration, and it's usually run by these kind of religiously affiliated groups. But this woman, Pam Stenzel, who's an abstinence educator, said at a conference called Reclaiming America for Christ, she said, "People of God, can I beg you to commit yourself to truth, not what works? I don't care if it works, because at the end of the day, I'm not answering to you, I'm answering to God." And that attitude, that the secular idea of what works is no longer what's important, is incredibly prevalent whenever you have this kind of faith-based influence in public health questions.
Yeah. You know, you said that this woman said, "I don't care what works, I'm interested in the truth." But there's a fascinating point that you make about how the Christian right has, in some sense, appropriated the postmodernism of the left, that kind of relativism idea that everybody has different stories, there's no absolute truth. I wonder if you could talk about this aspect.
Well, sure. When she says truth, she's not talking about the truth of science, which they all regard as kind of invalid. And yes, the postmodernism of it is so striking, because it basically holds that, you know, nobody really has the authority save Scripture, which is where they depart from postmodernism, to make any claims about what's true or false. So who are you to say that the world is more than 6,000 years old? That truth is only relative, and other stories about the creation of the world, including the account in Genesis, have just as much validity. I was at a creation conference where one of the speakers talked about our perspectives as being like putting on a pair of glasses. And he said, you've either got on God's word glasses or man's word glasses. So anything you see with your kind of limited secular perspective is considered almost de facto faulty and provisional.
You're a factinista, I think, as as we heard from Stephen Colbert at the press correspondence.
Right,
dinner.
Yeah, no, and so it's just really, that's the one thing I really tried to get across in this book, is that we're not just talking about different ideas about public policy, we're really talking about vastly different conceptions of reality.
Right. And a very kind of totalitarian vision. You say in the book that you're not arguing that America's on the cusp of religious totalitarianism, but at the end of the book, you advise, I think only partly tongue-in-cheek, to keep your passport updated and a bag packed.
It's mostly tongue-in-cheek. It's a kind of a tricky thing to talk about, because I find it very alarming, but I don't want to be alarmist. I mean, I don't want to say that they're the Christians are coming and they're marching down the street. I don't think that we're going to be shipped off to re-education camp in South Dakota anytime soon.
Is that more, though, an emotional decision that you don't, you know, because I think we're all in this thing, we can't believe this is happening.
Well,
we can't
right,
believe they'll really take over. Yet, there are some pretty scary parallels here.
And it's a very subtle process. And this is what, you know, I always talk to people and they say, well, you know, what do I care? This isn't going to affect me. And I would say, you know, it probably won't yet until it does. You know, your life goes on as normal until you find out that the rules have changed. And so it's subtle and sometimes hard to notice as it's happening, but then it's also in many ways very profound.
You make some parallels, and I'm going to say this because I've been seeing them for a long time. I'm a kind of a student of Nazi Germany and how fascism came to Europe. And you draw some parallels, too. And I wonder if you could talk about them and then make some distinctions.
Sure. Well, actually, I'd like to make the distinctions first, because I don't want to say that I'm comparing, I think a Dallas Morning News review of my book said that I was comparing Christians to Nazis. And that's not what I want to do. You know, when I talk about it, I say proto-totalitarianism. So this is about a kind of a nascent totalitarianism. It's about totalitarianism before it has the power to start sending stormtroopers out into the streets. And so, first of all, I quote Hannah Arendt a lot in this book, and she talks about, in The Origins of Totalitarianism, a kind of key feature of totalitarian movements is the way they construct this alternative reality and the way that they say that facts are totally dependent on the man who has the power to create them or to enforce them. And she also talks about how one thing totalitarian movements do is create kind of parallel institutions that kind of mimic the institutions of ordinary life, and then they try to replace one with the other. And you see this in the Bush administration where, you know, these kind of parallel Christian right medical organizations have now become the breeding ground for the people in the health bureaucracy, where they used to be taken from, you know, the kind of medical establishment. And then there is the kind of demonization. You know, I have a chapter in my book called Protocols of the Elders of San Francisco. This is not a movement.
And that's based on the Protocols of the Elders of Zion,
the
anti-Semitic screed that was first concocted by the Tsar, right?
Or by some Tsarist official. Now there's not, you know, there's strains of anti-Semitism, but the chief enemy of this movement is certainly not the Jews. It's what they often call the homosexual agenda. And it goes beyond, in many ways, simply being homophobic or anti-gay, because it posits this whole vast homosexual conspiracy. And if you read some of these books on the homosexual agenda and books like The Pink Swastika, you know, all by people who are kind of respected within the movement, people who are by no means on the fringes of American politics, they will talk about how, you know, homosexuals are this kind of like vast network that is seeking to undermine America and to insinuate itself into every aspect of our life and to steal our children. And there's even this whole kind of revisionist history. I mentioned the pink swastika, in which gay people weren't victims of the Nazis. That's just part of the homosexual conspiracy that's, you know, propagated that. In fact, Nazism was a homosexual movement, and the gay rights movement is its descendant. And so it kind of channels this national anxiety and this national fear over social breakdown and the kind of dissolution of social bonds. It gives them this coherent enemy, and it's the reason, I think, why so many people have put aside so many other concerns to vote to strip gay people of a host of rights. I mean, this isn't just about marriage. In many of the states, you know, I talk about Ohio. There's also, you know, going to be a law coming up in Virginia. In many of the places where people have voted on these so-called gay marriage amendments, they go much further and they strip gay people of, say, the right to share health insurance, to share child custody, to make medical decisions for each other, to establish, you know, all the kinds of legal bonds that by which, you know, gay families are able to function in the world. It's not just kind of precluding gay people from getting married, which, while unjust, is something that it's not taking away something that they already had. You're actually seeing people lose the rights, you know, that not only people have already struggled for, but that they've kind of built their lives around.
Now, you started out by saying you were going to say what the distinction is. And what I heard you say is that the distinction is that they don't have the power yet to kind of put their vision, their Christian nationalist vision, in which everything is judged according to biblical law, into practice. You know, as I read the history of fascism, certainly as it was in Germany and then in the countries that Germany invaded, often people talked about how, you know, it started with a little bit here and a little bit there. You know, that famous line. First they come for the Jews, or they come for the gypsies, and then eventually they come for me. So I'm wondering, is this what you're saying? Is you're saying that the distinction is that they don't have the power yet?
That's part of it. The other part of the distinction, I would say, is that they don't have a violent paramilitary wing. I mean, there are anti-abortion terrorists. There is the militia movement. But for the most part, the thing that distinguishes, say, like totalitarianism from proto-totalitarianism is when you start seeing the kind of, you know, militant thugs out in the streets, you know, bashing people's heads and...
Right, but do they need to have that? As you point out, they have made vast inroads into the military.
They have, and I don't know. I find it all very troubling. I mean, and you certainly are seeing a lot of Christian nationalist indoctrination in the military. And interestingly, when people have tried to speak up and stop this, you've seen a kind of uproar in Congress. You know, there was a big scandal not long ago when it turned out that in the United States Air Force Academy, professors were introducing themselves as Christians and saying, I hope you'll find Jesus by the end of the term. Upperclassmen who have authority over lowerclassmen were pressuring them to convert. They were calling the Jews Christ killers, and if they didn't want to pray, they had to march back to their rooms in what was called the heathen flight. It was such a clear violation. And yet, when they tried to take steps to kind of stop forced proselytization, there was this big uproar, and, you know, you had a bunch of congressmen writing a letter and James Dobson talking about this is just part of the war on Christians. And as a result, the Air Force decided to basically scrap the new policies that were meant to prevent this sort of thing. And so I see it as kind of subtle and frightening and kind of inexorable, but I would also say we don't need to panic. I still think that there's quite a bit of distance that they need to travel before we really lose our country entirely.
Well, what's it going to take? You say you don't think the remedy is reconciliation or healing between, you know, red and blue America, you know, between the right and the left, but that we've got to fight. How are we going to do that?
Well, I mean, I would say there's room for healing, certainly between certain parts of the so-called red states, but I would say that trying to kind of win over the religious right or the Christian nationalists is completely futile. I mean, they are kind of fundamentally opposed to us having any place in this country at all. I think that there's a few things. I mean, first of all, it's important to look at what they've accomplished through sheer old-fashioned political door-to-door organizing. And that's something that the left has really lost, partly, I think, for kind of structural reasons. We just don't have the community infrastructure that we used to have. You know, the megachurches really serve a lot of the same purpose that union halls used to serve. It's not just that they're religious places. They really constitute a kind of whole social world. And that kind of social network is, you know, missing from America, and so you don't have those same channels with which to organize within. And I think, you know, in certain ways, there's things beginning. I mean, there's organizing among progressive religious people. There's the beginning of a kind of a liberal echo chamber within the blogosphere. And then finally, I think that ultimately any attempt to really combat this growing movement has to be about electoral reform. Because part of the reason that this movement has so much power, part of the reason that, as I said before, 42 senators voted with the Christian Coalition 100% of the time, is because of the kind of massively disproportionate power given to conservative states, you know, in the Senate and Electoral College through apportionment, and in the Congress through redistricting. You know, one of the kind of things that could easily happen in 2006 is that Americans could vote pretty decisively to restore both houses of Congress to Democrats, and it could not matter. I mean, let's say 53% of Americans vote for Democrats in 2006. It's entirely possible that that won't be enough and that Republicans will maintain control of both houses. And so as long as these kind of structural inequalities are there, pulling the country in a more democratic, you know, both small and large D direction is going to be really difficult.
You are on the board of something called the Campaign to Defend the Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
What is that, and where can people go to find out more about it?
The Campaign to Defend the Constitution, it's actually some of the same people who were behind the growth of Move On have now joined to form an organization that's basically devoted to fighting the religious right nationally and through these media campaigns. So you can go to defconamerica.org. For example, they try to, whenever somebody is trying to introduce creationism into the public schools, they work hard to bring media attention to it, you know, to kind of compete with the right-wing radio infrastructure. They've run ads about the links of various religious right leaders to Jack Abramoff and the gambling investigations. And there's other organizations that are really valuable. I mean, in Massachusetts, Political Research Associates has done invaluable research on the right.
Right, that's Chip Berlay.
That's right. And he's also on the board of advisors of the Campaign to Defend the Constitution. You know, there's numerous groups. I think that part of it is just that, you know, the other side has a 30-year jump on us in a lot of ways and are networked together a lot more. But certainly there's people out there, you know, kind of working it and making a difference.
Right. Just on the final note here, I was having a hard time imagining what it must be like to do a book like this, to be as far from these folks as it might be possible in terms of your own worldview, and to be among them. I wonder if you could say something about what it was like.
Sure. I mean, it was often pretty exhausting, and I would usually, you know, I would go somewhere for anywhere from a couple of days to a week. Usually I would just kind of hang out in the background for a while, you know, if I was going to see what some of these preachers are saying in church. I usually was able to kind of be unobtrusive and just have people talk around me and not pay that much attention to me. And it was sometimes hard, I think, to separate the fact that a lot of the people in the movement, like a lot of people everywhere, are perfectly sweet, amiable, welcoming people on a one-on-one basis. The trick is to remember that that doesn't mean that their ideology is friendly or that they don't mean what they say. You know, somebody can be really, really friendly, and when they talk about us being kind of locked in a war between believers and non-believers for dominance in this country, they mean it, even if they are perfectly willing to have me over for Sunday brunch after church. And then the other thing is just you're so immersed in this parallel reality that after a while you almost kind of start thinking in two tracks in your head. You know, you see things through your own eyes, and then you start seeing things as you imagine the people that you've been among will also see them. And I found myself constantly arguing with them in my head. And I would sometimes start arguing with people after a while. And often I would say, you know, people were sometimes pretty eager to engage because it's not as if these views are something that they hold kind of furtively and secretly.
Right. They're convinced. Well, the book is Kingdom Coming, The Rise of Christian Nationalism. It's a very important book, I think, for all of us to read. Thank you so much, Michelle Goldberg, for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Goldberg will be speaking at Stockbridge Booksellers in Stockbridge, Mass. On July 8th at 3 p.m.